Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New Republic editor-at-large Peter Beinart is a scoop Jackson Democrat who wants American liberals to stand up, suit up, grab their ideals and their guns, and win the war on terror. Conservatives can talk big and shake the stick, but they can't win this one, he says. They're too arrogant, too polarizing, too blinded by belief that America is always right. But liberals still paralyzed by Vietnam won't cut it either, he says. It's time for fighting Democrats in the mold of Harry Truman to pull the country together, join hands with the world, and win. Up next, On Point, a liberal call to arms and the good fight in the war on terror with the New Republic's Peter Beinart. Peter Beinart, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Peter.
Peter, let's dive right in. There's rough news all over the place. We're deploying more troops in Iraq. Afghanistan looks lousy over the weekend. Make your case right from the start about why conservatives cannot win the war on terror. It at one point was counterintuitive, maybe not now. What's the argument you make? Why can't conservatives do it?
Because I think that while conservatives recognize that we're going to win this ultimately by spreading freedom around the world, what they don't recognize, and in fact have not really recognized since, didn't recognize during the Cold War as well, is that America has to live up to the ideals that it preaches. When America speaks about promoting democracy around the world, but in fact is complacent about its own record on democracy and human rights, it undermines the very ideals that we preach. The reason that our push for democracy and human rights and freedom was legitimate in the Cold War, particularly in the early Cold War, because people outside the United States saw a society in America that was struggling to become better itself. We didn't simply say, we are a model for a benighted world. We said, what will inspire the world is our struggle against injustice and lack of freedom at home, to overcome McCarthyism, to overcome segregation. There is no such sense that America is involved in a moral mission itself, that it's challenging itself in the Bush administration, and that has come at great cost to the United States.
So connect the dots on that argument. What's the evidence you see of trouble that you can link back to the conservative sort of self-righteousness, if that's what you're describing it as?
Well, one could start with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, for instance. There are many brave liberals and Democrats in the Arab world who need America's help. They need our expertise. They need our money. They need our encouragement. But they have been so tremendously undermined by what they can see on their TV screens. We live in a globalized world where what America does is more and more evident to the rest of the world than ever before. And the dramatic, painful disconnect between our high-minded rhetoric, between our vigilance about other countries respecting human rights, and our complacency, our arrogant complacency about our own violations of human rights, which have really been legion since 9/11, has tremendously undermined our moral authority in the world. And the response you hear from people like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney is, because we are the United States, we are incapable of committing violations of human rights. When Amnesty International attacked the Guantanamo Bay situation, George W. Bush said, that's absurd. We're a country that promotes freedom. Everyone knows that. No, everyone doesn't know that. America cannot simply assert its virtue and expect the world to take it on faith. We have to prove it. We have to earn it. And we haven't been doing so.
But when you look around and make the argument that liberals can and must, that only liberals can win the war on terror, you're looking pretty far back. You're looking back in history. What are you looking back there for, Peter?
I'm looking for the liberalism that emerged at the beginning of the Cold War. You know, the Cold War emerged very quickly in the United States, not quite as quickly as 9/11, but very quickly it overtook the American consciousness. And what the Truman administration and a series of liberal intellectuals who influenced it recognized was that the United States would not defeat the Soviet Union alone. it would not defeat the Soviet Union simply by asserting that we were better than them. It would defeat the Soviet Union by persuading the world that America was a more benign power. And the only way to persuade the world, this is something that George W. Bush has never understood, you can't persuade unless you're willing to be persuaded. And what the Truman administration did, really radical and remarkable if you think about it compared to our times, was they took the United States, representing 50% of the world's GDP, imagine that, at the end of the end of World War II, Western Europe, East Asia, on its knees. The United States voluntarily gave over some of its power through international institutions like NATO and the UN to weaker countries because we said, don't trust that we are going to be a benign power. Come and have some influence over our policies, and together, through things like NATO and the Marshall Plan, we will build a Western alliance that is superior to the Soviet Union. And it worked. Worked beautifully.
Came out very tough, implemented containment instead of direct confrontation, and we know how that turned out ultimately. But there's an argument inside the liberal camp, which conservatives point to say, you can't win this war because you won't win it. And it goes from Henry Wallace, you point to in the 1940s, to Michael Moore today, the camp that says America is not just not always right, it's almost always wrong, and we shouldn't be out there wielding all this military might and pushing power around. What about that? Are the liberals too divided to win?
I think that liberals can overcome that division. You're right. Part of the book is to trace this debate within liberalism that starts with Henry Wallace's challenge to Harry Truman in the presidential election of 1948. The real debate is about whether liberals have enemies that are not on the right. Wallace's argument is that communists, and he's not a communist himself, but he says that communists are allies in the struggle against conservatives, in the struggle for civil rights.
He was talking about the Soviet Union there, saying let's work with them, not be in opposition to them.
Let's work with them. And the Truman argument, and made by intellectuals like Arthur Schlesinger and Reinhold Niebuhr, was in fact that liberals had an argument with the right, a very deep argument, but liberalism also had to be defined against what they called totalitarianism, the idea of a state that wanted to extinguish all individual freedom in pursuit of a kind of utopian messianic vision that the Nazis had, that the communists have. And I try to argue in the book that jihadism is a totalitarian vision as well, and that struggling against it has to be at the core of the liberal project. And beyond that, that liberals have to recognize that when we struggle against jihadism in the world, we will not be able to remain totally morally pure. One of the things that Henry Wallace said when Harry Truman wanted to send aid to Greece and Turkey in 1947 was, I will only support this if it goes through the UN. But he knew that because the Soviet Union was on the Security Council, the UN would not act. Schlesinger called this kind of purity which leads to ineffectiveness, to not doing anything at all. He called it doe-face liberalism. And this is a strain that does still exist today. If you look at MoveOn.org's response to the war in Afghanistan, for instance, where they said, we will support military action, but only if no innocent civilians are killed. That's doe-face liberalism, a kind of liberalism which is so morally pure that it prevents America from ever acting. That is the other danger that liberals must avoid.
We'll look at whether you're then raising the flag of a kind of liberal neoconservatism. But let me ask you first to describe, if you would, what this war on terror would look like in liberal hands. We've seen what it looks like in George W. Bush's hands, Dick Cheney and others. If it were liberals, the ones you say are the only ones who can win it, what would it look like? How would it look different?
I think, first of all, it would start with America being very open about trying to set a model for the world in the way we deal with the very difficult human rights issues that are faced by our treatment of terrorist prisoners, for instance. It would involve a call exactly the opposite of what George W. Bush has done. George W. Bush has tried to liberate America from international institutions on the theory that while other countries might need international law and international institutions to act well, we are so pure that we don't. Liberals would do exactly the opposite. They do what Harry Truman did. There was an extraordinary burst of institution building in the late 1940s, led by liberals in the United States, on the theory that what America wanted to do was embed its power legitimately within international institutions so that our ideals would be seen as legitimate around the world. There are a whole series of institutions, from the UN to the WHO, which have atrophied over time, that are not up to meeting the challenges. And the United States, as we've seen, cannot do it alone. We need to do it within a legitimate international fora, but we have to take the lead in creating the institutions, today's NATO's, today's UN, today's IMF and World Bank, that in fact are big enough for the kinds of challenges we face.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of it? Out with the conservative effort, in, says Peter Beinart, with the liberal war on terror. That's the only one, he says, that can win.
Well, as Peter points out, another barrier within conservatism to fighting this war is the conservative attack on government and their fixation on cutting taxes, their desire to fight wars on the cheap. And as we've seen with our homeland defenses, that can't be done. And presumably liberals would say, no, we have to pay for our military adventures. We have to actually fund our defenses, and especially the homeland security effort. I think that's a very important difference. Another difference is that conservatives do believe the country is perfect. I think he brings that out very well. There's a sense that, well, we are America. And that just simply means that anything we do is fine, whereas there's more self-doubt among liberals. But that's precisely the point. There is self-doubt. And, you know, I think that, Peter, you're very right when you say that this war in Iraq has really made a lot of liberals or Democrats feel very uneasy about the war on terror, that this has seemed such, this is such a disaster, and this has hurt us in so many parts of the world and in so many dimensions of the challenge we face, that I think a lot of people just feel, listen, let's just cut our losses, protect ourselves, retrench, do a little development aid, but military adventures are really things that we have to put behind us.
Peter, is that retreat, surrender, is that what the conservatives crow the liberals will do and lose?
Well, I think that one of the great tragedies that we've seen over the past several years is that the country was very united in the wake of 9/11 for the first year or so after 9/11, with not much of a difference between the way liberals and conservatives registered in public opinion polls. But the Bush administration and Karl Rove relentlessly went out to make the war on terror a wedge issue because they saw it as one in which they could profit politically. And tragically, as Jack Beatty rightly says, partly because of the alienation bred by the war in Iraq, they have to some degree succeeded. We now see quite massive gaps between the way Democrats and Republicans are self-described liberals and conservatives in public opinion polls, the degree to which they see the war on terror as a priority. Liberals much, much less likely to see it as a priority. And I think that really is tragic.
David's calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I guess if I had to identify myself, I would be a more from the Gene McCarthy and Wallace wing of the party. But I actually am a honest-to-goodness liberal homeland security consultant, and I find it's interesting. I do a blog on the subject, and I write as much about problems like the signing statements and...
This is the president making exceptions to all kinds of legislation for himself, yeah?
Exactly, and all of that kind of thing, as I do about technology dealing with homeland security, because I see all of these issues as a continuum. And, in fact, I would even argue that appealing to traditional fiscal conservatives, that you can actually fight the war on terror much more economically with a liberal perspective, because we don't see all of these issues sort of in line with what Jack was saying. We don't see these issues in isolation. We, you know, if we violate our First Amendment rights and everything else at home, and it just makes things that much more difficult for us abroad. We create more problems domestically because of the budget deficit.
Right. So you see a continuum here. But let me ask you, David, then, if you're the Gene McCarthy Democrat and Peter Beinart is the Scoop Jackson Democrat, when it comes to push comes to shove, are you ready to pick up the gun as part of the war on terror and fight that or not?
Well, I was a conscientious objector, so I guess not. But my oldest son is a major in the Green Berets, so at least the family is contributing. But he also is worried about some of these excesses, I should say. And I think the other thing is that I don't remember having brought up on the show is unilateralism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'd be much better off with multilateral approaches and you know, giving strength again to the United Nations rather than sending John Bolton there to destroy it.
So you're lined up with Peter Beinart on that. But Peter, let me put it to you then. You hear this is in many ways a very typical Democratic Party voice. It says, yes, we've got to see this holistically, but no, not so ready to be the Scoop Jackson Democrat. So at bottom, when you add it up, are the liberals ready to stand up and do this, or are they still torn in their own ranks about what to do?
I think their liberals are still torn, and this probably won't be resolved until we have another Democratic president. I want to underscore something that the caller said, which I think is incredibly important, but something that Cold War liberals understood and that the Bush administration doesn't, which is that ultimately America's ability to be a strong force for freedom around the world depends upon our strength at home, that an administration that relentlessly cuts taxes in the face of a baby boom retirement that is going to send us into fiscal crisis is not an administration that will be able to sustain the spending on homeland security and even the military spending, let alone the kind of foreign aid spending that we need to ultimately defeat jihadism. And beyond that, one of the reasons that America could last out the Soviet Union, that we could embark on this long-term project of containment, that we could be stronger than them over the long haul, was that in late 1940s and 50s and 1960s, life got better for average Americans. What you saw was that working-class Americans in particular saw their standards of living rise and rise, partly because of wise government interventions in the economy like Social Security and Medicare, partly because of the power of labor unions. One of the great problems we're going to have that the Bush administration is not addressing is that the economic weakness of average Americans who have by and large seen their lives get significantly tougher since the early 1970s makes it much harder for the United States to sustain international expenditures abroad. People keep on saying, wait a second, you're not doing enough for us at home. That's also a very important part of this long-term struggle that we're in, one that has been neglected, I think, by this administration.
50 years ago, you remind us, the Americans for Democratic Action liberal group warned that, quoting you, a political system ruled by business would produce a government too weak to defend freedom. But I've got to ask you, Peter Beinart, of course, it was Democrats who took the country into Vietnam. That turned out to be a big fiasco. So where do you get this confidence that Dems will do it right? I mean, there was JFK, there was LBJ and his guy, Bob McNamara. If that got so screwed up, why wouldn't the war on terror equally?
Well, you're absolutely right. Liberals, Democrats are not angels, certainly prone to error. I think it's important in understanding Vietnam to remember a couple of things. First of all, that it was partly relentless pressure from the right, really starting with the McCarthy period, when people on the right accused the Truman administration of losing China, that put the pressure on Kennedy and then Johnson that made it so difficult for them to come to a realistic accounting of the fact that we were not going to be able to win in South Vietnam, which was an artificially created country. That had no popular support, but also that there were many, many liberals themselves from very early on who argued against the Vietnam War, that while there were liberals, it's true, in the administration of Lyndon Johnson who supported and prosecuted that war, most of the most vehement critics, in fact, themselves were Cold War liberals. People like Arthur Schlesinger, Reinhold Niebuhr, George Kennan themselves became very passionate critics of Vietnam, not because they were against containment, but in fact because they saw that the moral basis of containment, which meant defending countries that really had a national identity, defending democracies, wasn't being played out in South Vietnam, which was an artificially created country split to prevent the Vietnamese from getting full independence after France left. That it really represented a perversion of the Cold War liberal tradition.
But there's Vietnam sitting big and large over this argument. Suma's calling from Bowie, Maryland. Hi, Suma, you're on the air.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The most important thing that we, the liberals, and I say we because I class myself there,
all right,
have to do is, first of all, stop shying away from the word liberal, because we have let the conservatives define liberal for us. If we take charge and define liberal the way it should be and actually be proud to be called liberal.
Okay, Mr. Liberal, how are you going to win the war on terror? How?
We're going to win the war on terror because the values that we stand for, centered around the core values that makes America what it is, that makes the world admire us, and those values are centered around the concept of freedom. And freedom, not as defined by the conservatives, but defined by the liberals in terms of showing compassion and the stick to show that we are still mighty and strong enough to make certain things done when we want them done.
Okay.
But portraying that love and compassion that was established by Kennedy, that made the entire world admire America, and that actually started this influx into America.
Suma, we've got it. So run up the flag. Run it up proud. Say liberal. Talk about freedom. Peter Beinart, George Bush talks about freedom all the time. He's made it one of his major words. Why is that a liberal word?
I think Suma has hit on something very important. It's true that George W. Bush talks about democracy and liberty, but a core part of the liberal tradition is equality of opportunity. It's the recognition that democracies fail if they don't make their people's lives better. That, in fact, that was part of what saved American democracy when democracies were failing around the world during the Depression, was government intervention to make people more free by giving them the economic opportunity that makes freedom real, that people who are economically desperate and in despair are not truly free.
So the George Peace Corps will win the war on terror? Is that the idea at some level? The Peace Corps?
The Marshall Plan under Truman, point four, his effort to extend it to the Third World Alliance for Progress in Latin America under Kennedy, the Peace Corps, these kind of things, Tony Blair talks about them, but George W. Bush doesn't talk about them very much. The truth is, it is not one of the reasons that democracies are not emerging in the Middle East is these countries have been economically stagnated, cut off from the world economy from decades. What Truman understood with the Marshall Plan was that unless democracies provided for their people, unless they gave their people hope of a better life, democracies themselves might fail. We see in countries like India, which have very large Muslim populations, that where there is economic hope, very little terrorism emerges. And yet the Bush administration has been very timid, very, very minimal in its efforts to really lead a new struggle for economic development in the Third World.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of this balance of olive branch and arrows, of development and military might? Does it sound fundamentally different from George Bush's? Does it sound like a winner?
It doesn't sound like a winner. And that's because if you ask the average American about foreign aid, basically they think we spend on foreign aid what we spend on defense. And this has been a gold mine for conservative demagogues for generations. And so then you get into this other question that if you say, wait a minute, we have to talk about the roots of terrorism. We have to talk about the sea in which the terrorists swim. Yep. We have to talk about the degradation of women. We have to have a Marshall Plan for the Middle East. If you say that, then the conservatives say, wait a minute, you're talking about root causes here, and we're talking about evil. And evil doesn't need to be explained, doesn't need to be understood, just resisted. So you're fighting two headwinds there, the feeling that foreign aid is a big ripoff and that it doesn't do any good and that we give too much of it. And, of course, we don't even give a fraction of what people think. And two, that if you start talking about what's wrong fundamentally in the Middle East and we have to deal with it, then you're making apologies for the terrorists.
So you're saying, Jack, that Peter Beinart's prescription here won't sell with Americans, that this narrative of national greatness that he's putting out won't fly at home?
I don't believe so. I don't believe you can sell a Marshall Plan for the Middle East. However, I mean, even assuming, of course, that any of these nations would want our aid in this form, I don't think people would go for it. The effort of explaining why would get you into all these problems, these two logical or political problems that I mentioned.
Peter, we'll give you a chance to respond to that, but first I want to bring into our conversation from New York, Max Boot is with us. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, contributing editor to the conservative Weekly Standard, author of the forthcoming book, War Made New, Technology, Warfare, and the Course of History, 1500 to Today. That's pretty ambitious. Sweet. Max Boot, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
What do you make of Peter Beinart's prescription here? Liberals, only liberals, can win the war on terror, and we better get them at it quickly because the conservatives are messing up.
Well, I agree with part of what Peter is saying, because certainly I agree that if the Democratic Party is going to remain a viable force in national security debates, it needs to get much tougher and go back to its Cold War heritage of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy and others, and eschew the kind of George McGovern, Henry Wallace rhetoric which MoveOn.org and George Soros and others indulge in the present day. I think that's absolutely correct. Where I disagree with Peter a little bit is this conceit that only the Democrats, only the liberals can win the war on terrorism, which is somewhat ironic because Peter, you know, attacks conservatives and Republicans for being overly partisan and turning the war on terrorism into a partisan issue. And yet what's more partisan than saying that only my party can win the war on terrorism, whereas in fact I think the reality is we need to be bipartisan. We need to have both parties come together and agree on a common program to win the war on terrorism. And I think it's absurd to say, based on either history or a reading of the present day, that only the Democrats can win it or that Republicans will mess everything up.
But Republicans have hardly been paragons of bipartisanship during these years of the war on terror, so they can hardly hold that flag up as theirs to own.
Well, it's certainly true that Republicans have been partisan on occasion, but so have Democrats. Both sides have plenty of blame to go around, and I don't think it helps matters to have a book which says only the Democrats can win the war on terrorism, whereas, in fact, I think only both parties united, which is what happened in the early years of the Cold War. I mean, you can talk about the Marshall Plan and all the great things done by the Truman administration, and I agree, but it was made possible because they had supportive Republicans on Capitol Hill like Arthur Vandenberg and others. It was the two sides working together that was so vitally important. And the other point I would raise about Peter's thesis is I think there are grave doubts about to what extent the Democrats today will embrace his ideas. Because, in fact, the nature of the Democratic Party has changed tremendously over the course of the last 40 or 50 years. You have to remember, in the early years of the Cold War, the Southern white vote was a solid Democratic vote, and this was the region of the country that was always traditionally the most pro-military, strong in national security. But in the succeeding years, Democrats have completely lost that white Southern vote, which is now in the Republican Party, and the base of the Democratic Party has shifted much more to the left, to the coastal elites on both the East and West Coast. And so I think groups like MoveOn.org and and George Soros and others are much more representative of the Democratic Party today than the Henry Wallaces were in the 1940s.
Mr. Boot, let me put those to Peter Beinart. Peter, pick those two up. First of all, why only liberals can win? Are you excluding half the country here? And second, Max Boot says, you know, you can propose this, but he doesn't see that kind of liberal at home in the party anymore, at the heart of it.
I didn't say only Democrats. I said only liberals. This is really a book about liberals. It's true that liberalism is much better manifested in the Democratic Party today than in the Republican Party. But it wasn't always that way, and it need not be. In fact, I would say that when the Republican Party, when certain elements in the Republican Party decided to be aggressively in support of international institutions and in support of things like the Marshall Plan and greater economic development aid, in fact, they were representing liberal principles that the Republican Party has abandoned. It's when the Republican Party turned to the kind of red baiting of Richard Nixon and Joseph McCarthy, that they lost faith with those principles. So when I talk about liberalism, I don't mean it. I draw an important distinction between that and Democrats. I think they're liberal principles that will win the war on terror.
But not many Rockefeller Republicans these days to pick those up.
Not many Rockefeller Republicans, but that could change very fast. Remember, you know, imagine if John McCain were to win. There are things on which I disagree with John McCain, but John McCain, I think, recognizes in a way that this administration and many conservative commentators really have not since 9/11, that the United States, for instance, on the issue of torture, that the United States really has to live the ideals that it preaches, and that is incredibly important around the world.
And what about Max's argument?
That's something that I think I think that's something that people in the Republican Party could return to.
What about Max's argument that you've got so many McGovern-style Democrats today, that you're not going to have an army of liberals stand up with you on this?
I think he's overstating that case. The vast, vast majority of Democrats in Congress, I think all except for one, and most liberals in the country supported the war in Afghanistan. And I think if Al Gore had been president, he would have done that. What we're really seeing, and in fact, Bill Clinton, by the end of his presidency, took very aggressive action preemptively in Kosovo, for instance, with an international alliance, and it had widespread support on the left. What's happened is in the last two or three years, as the result of the way George W. Bush won the elections of 2002 and 2004, and Iraq, you have seen a move back to the Wallace and McGovern position. But there's no reason that can't change, and can't change quickly. Remember, it was just a few years ago that it was Democrats who were arguably, in the late 1990s, more hawkish than Republicans, liberals more hawkish than conservatives, in conservative large-scale unwillingness to support American military intervention in the Balkans, although there were honorable exceptions, like the Weekly Standard.
Max Boot, we've just got half a minute before the break. Peter Beinart says he'll leave the door open for liberal-minded Republicans. He's happy to make it bipartisan, but you've got to have that liberal impulse, the acknowledgement of American imperfections in there to sell it.
I don't think you have to wring your hands about American imperfections, which is not something that people like FDR or Truman or John F. Kennedy did. In fact, quite the opposite. They talked about paying any price, bearing any burden. I don't think that's the problem. And I think to some extent Peter is right. There is a constituency in both the Democratic and Republican parties, but the irony is the constituency in the Republican Party, which is most amenable to the prescriptions he lays out, are the so-called neoconservatives, who are the people who are most vilified on the left.
Max Boot, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Tom's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a quick comment to make that I want to use to preface as I move into a question. And the comment is just that there's been a lot of talk about the Cold War and the 40-plus years that were associated with that. And just a quick reminder, that was made up of both liberal and conservative administrations. In fact, if memory serves me, it fell during a conservative administration. But that's neither here nor there. I think it's a joint effort. The question that I have is that with America's increasing role, certainly from a global standpoint, tracing it back over 100 years and our involvement in the world wars, along with others, I think more and more there is a greater expectation of the United States and where it should be within the world. I guess my problem is that that doesn't seem, and this might speak more to Jack's point about why Americans aren't going to buy this idea, is that it's not reciprocated. And I think if...
Not reciprocated by whom, Tom?
By all the different reasons to which we do, whether you're talking about military interventions because it's requested or it's part of containment, or alternatively, whether it's, you know, an initiative for some type of human relief, whether it's Somalia, whether it's Bosnia.
You mean it's not appreciated? It's not welcome?
No. Well, yes, I think it is appreciated at the local level. The problem is that in the global sense, the recognition isn't there. And so from a globalism standpoint, in which America is getting increasingly involved with, it doesn't seem as though there's an acceptance across the board. And I guess my question is, you know, with that in mind, really, can the concept of just going down a particular liberal persuasion route really be that which will work? And I just have some doubts on that.
Let us pick it up. Peter Beinart, I guess implicit in that is that there may not be enough moral authority left in the bank for liberals to go out and do this without some of the same kind of resistance that conservatives are running into all over the world now.
It's critically important that liberals convince Americans that liberals will be willing to use force when necessary. If people don't believe that about liberals, then I think they will not buy the other part of the argument. If Harry Truman hadn't been willing to show Americans that he was willing to create NATO, to give military aid to Greece and Turkey to fight the Korean War, then I think the arguments for the Marshall Plan would have been much weaker. That's why it's critically important that liberals take on groups in their own wing, in their own coalition, that in fact are not seem unwilling to use military force. But I would just point out to the caller, I think we don't realize what an extraordinary impact it makes in the around the world when the United States actually does live up to its principles. Let me give you an example. The Bush administration's immediate response to the tsunami in Indonesia was very minimal and timid, but it got it right. After a few days, it dramatically increased aid. If you remember, the U.S. military even went to help.
Yep.
The impact on public opinion in Indonesia from that American humanitarian intervention was extraordinary. We see now in Indonesia that Indonesia, the perceptions of the United States went dramatically up, and perceptions of Osama bin Laden, this is what's most remarkable, went tremendously down. Indonesia became, in the wake of our tsunami relief, the first Muslim country ever polled to show a plurality in support of America's war on terror, because people saw the United States as actually doing something to make people's lives better. We restored our legitimacy. We don't hear enough about that, but America still really has the ability to inspire the world when we act, and when we do, we become much safer. As a result, imagine how many terrorists could come out of Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world. You could argue that our response to the tsunami in Indonesia has been our single greatest success outside of the war in Afghanistan since 9/11.
You say do that on a global scale and maybe the worm will turn. But what about where the chips are down and dirty and difficult? What about Iraq right now? You favored going in there. If liberals were in charge of that war, how would it be different? Would it be different?
I favored that war, and in all honesty, I was wrong. I think that I could not see that Saddam Hussein, in fact, didn't have a nuclear weapons program. He had one for so long that I was blind to the evidence that started to mount just in the weeks before we went to war, that in fact that fairly widespread perception was wrong.
Is that an argument that MoveOn.org is right, that your kind of neocon, liberal neocon view of the world is too ready to pull that trigger?
Well, my criticism for Move On was their opposition to the war in Afghanistan, not their opposition to the war in Iraq.
But does your what you now describe as a mistake on Iraq indicate that there's something fundamentally right about their critique, that if you get armed up and ready to go, you're likely to do it when it might not be right?
No. And what's fundamentally different from the argument that I'm making, and I take great pains in the book to explain how this difference has played out historically, and what makes this different from the neoconservative argument, is that neocons are hostile to international cooperation and international institutions. They want America to act alone or at least have complete freedom of action. The model for America, NATO or Bill Clinton's war in Kosovo, is military action, aggressive military action that has international legitimacy, that is done through a coalition of partners, through international institutions like NATO. That's what we didn't have in Iraq, and that's where I think one of my failings of not recognizing how important UN or at least NATO support would be in us having legitimacy in Iraq. That said, I would not favor pulling out of Iraq right now. I think if we have, since we have a democratically elected government that is fighting to try to create some kind of control there, if that government wants us to stay a bit longer while it tries to develop some legitimacy amongst the people, we have, I think, it's a question of honor, it seems to me, for the United States, that we not, having turned that country upside down, leave them alone if their democratically elected government wants us to stay for a while longer.
Jack Beatty, what about it? Over time, a world transformed in its view of the United States if the U.S. shows a liberal rather than a conservative face, Peter Beinart suggests here, and that's the path to victory in the war on terror. Are you on board?
I don't know that the world will be on board, or the public, the American public, as I said earlier, because of the means that will have to be used in that war. The difference, presumably, is that liberals will talk about development. That's expensive, and that runs into the problem I mentioned earlier.
Not more expensive than Iraq, though, Jack, and Americans are pretty tuned into that bill right now.
Right, right. But, you know, war, in a strange way, if it works, it looks like a great winner. I mean, clearly war and prospect help the Republicans win the 2002 election, and it may well, the threat of war with Iran may have the same effect this year. No, it's just very hard to get people going about civilian aid and about aid to these countries. And I think this is part of the problem. Even using the term war on terror, you know, terror is a tactic. We don't have wars on amphibious landings. We need to almost redefine this. It is clearly a struggle against this particular group and others who mean us harm, but by constantly calling it a war, I think we're getting into that military intervention mindset, which, of course, undermines our long-term objective, which is to you know, win hearts and minds, to make people in the Middle East think that we're not, to make people in the Middle East think of us as people in Indonesia do, to show them another face of America other than the bombs and the massacres and so on.
Peter, that's an interesting element here. Are you and Scoop Jackson ready to pick up President Bush's formulation, War on Terror? Does that fit neatly into your view of how liberals ought to proceed, or do you want new language? Or would the new less than war language be the the new left view of the world?
I use the word war on terror in the cover because that's what people recognize. They will understand the subject of the book. But in the book itself, no, I usually refer to a struggle against jihadism. I agree. Jack Beatty is right. We are not fighting a tactic. We are fighting an ideology, a totalitarian ideology. And I think it's important for Americans to recognize and liberals to recognize that we have this rich history of anti-totalitarianism. On Jack's point that the country will not go for economic development, I think liberals have to be less timid in standing up for what they believe in. I think one of the things, I think you could see this with Al Gore, for instance, in the 2000 presidential campaign and global warming. The conventional wisdom is, well, people don't want to hear about that. And so he didn't really go and talk about who he really was and what he really believed. George W. Bush said something very interesting in 2004. He said, "You may not always agree with me, but you know where I stand." I think liberals need to remember that. Speaking about what they really believe makes you seem like someone, like a politician of conviction. I think Democrats and liberals should remember that. And you know, one more thing. The really remarkable thing about this debate about economic development, about fighting poverty and despair in the world as a way of making America safer, is that it is an argument that is picking up steam amongst evangelical Christians in the right wing of the Republican Party. They are the people who have pushed the Bush administration to do more in fighting for economic opportunity than it would have otherwise. I think we underestimate the American people when we think that we can't appeal to their conscience and that they won't have an innate understanding that a making America be a force for good and respected and believed in the world makes us safer.
That may also be pragmatism. Peering over the cliff we've looked over recently, an alternative may look good. Stephen's calling from Boston. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I guess, first of all, I'd like to say thanks to Peter for recognizing that we are, in fact, in this global insurgency. It's pretty rare to hear people both in and out of uniform recognize that. And having said that, I guess my concern about what he's advocating for is that it's sort of an absolutist perspective. And with everything that I know about counterinsurgency at this point, and I study it at length.
Are you an in-uniform guy, Stephen, may I ask?
Yes, sir. I'm an Army reservist here in Boston, and I'm preparing to go back to the Army full-time.
Okay.
And so I spend an inordinate amount of my time reading about insurgencies and counterinsurgencies.
And you've been in Iraq or not?
Yes, sir.
Okay,
yes, sir.
All right. So how do you see it then?
in any counterinsurgency fight, a government has to be united. And what I'm concerned about is if let's say, for sake of argument, that the liberal we have a liberal administration mm-hmm. in the White House, and mm-hmm. liberals sweep the Congress, what we wind up with is the exact opposite of where we are today. And I can tell you, as someone who was on the ground in Iraq in most of 2004 and part of 2005, having a divisive government that would practically say anything to hurt the other side was very, very, very detrimental to us on the ground.
So you just flip the sides around, but you still have the division, and you say that hurts.
Yes, sir. If you want to win this fight, we have to come together on some common ground, present a unified front, and move forward and win the fight. Plenty of time for politics later, but we have to defeat this growing jihadism in this world, where Iraq is not a war but a battleground, where Afghanistan is not a war but a battleground. Mm. And the only way that we can convince those populations in those countries is that, you know what, we are on your side, and no more of this talk about pulling out or any of this internal politics that we play here in the United States.
We're in it for real.
Yes, sir.
Stephen, we've got it, and I want to put that to Peter. Peter, well, you hear it, but can these two, you describe two great national narratives that are very different, conservative and liberal. So can they coexist in this kind of combine that Stephen wants to see at work abroad?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank Stephen, you know, sitting here in a studio in Washington, D.C. People like me who make our livings writing rely on people like him to defend us. And I couldn't write books like this without him. I couldn't do anything without people like him willing to go and fight for mm-hmm. our country. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that to him personally. The problem is that politics never ends in a democracy. It can't end. I think so you have to have a legitimate discussion of different ideas, different strategies for winning this struggle against jihadism. And my book tries to lay out one. But I think the critical difference, and what I would really hope that liberals or Democrats would not do, is take cheap shots at the opposition. When I think Democrats and liberals were absolutely wrong to pile on this Dubai ports deal, where I think George W. Bush was actually in the right, and liberals and Democrats took a cheap shot at him because they saw the polls and saw that he was weak and vulnerable. That's wrong. I think politics should be a contest of different ideas. That has to take place even in wartime. But it should not be an opportunity to be dishonest about what the other side believes or take cheap, unfair shots or impugn their patriotism. And I very badly hope that if liberals and Democrats are given another shot at power, they won't do that, because I think Stephen is absolutely right. It will hurt the country.
Let me try and get another quick call or two and hear Robert's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for having my call.
Sure.
I couldn't have put it better, the last caller. I think basically liberalism will overcome just about every problem in the world, terrorism, poverty, SARS, disease. But liberals in this country won't do it. The conservatives are too arrogant, and the liberals are incompetent.
So what's the way, Robert?
Well, I will illustrate that point about the Dubai port deals. And as Mr. Friedman says, that scares off a lot of Arab allies and has them courting a Chinese wife.
Mm-hmm. So you're not feeling confident in either direction? Let me get one more call here. Hitesh is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Hitesh. You're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. I just want to say, while I consider myself a liberal and I enjoy Peter Beinart's essays in the New Republic, mm-hmm. I think his point of view is taken up by the same kind of hubris that we see among the neocons. He sort of thinks that we can beam out, you know, our goodness, which I believe in. We are good in fundamental ways, and transform societies. And it's sort of like a self-helpism. You know, we're going to send them a little human, a little mill, and they're going to become different.
But if he's wrong, what's the alternative, Hitesh?
Well, I think we have to make different kinds of alliances with very local groups. I just don't think that societies can be transformed by external force in any positive way.
Our time is short. Let us pick it up right there. Peter, first, to that point, can it be done? And secondly, who's going to carry your flag in real-world politics here? But first, can you beam out American goodness? Is this hubris?
It's not hubris if America recognizes that we're not doing it alone. I would not argue that the United States should be itself redesigning the curriculum in Muslim societies. That's not what we did in the Marshall Plan. This is very important to remember. The Marshall Plan was not drawn up by the United States. The United States said to Western Europe, you draw up a plan working together that follows democratic principles. In fact, it was much more socialistic than Americans would ever have done at home, but it had local legitimacy. That, I think, is the model. There are people crying out, if you look at the Arab Human Development Reports published from the UN, crying out from within the Middle East itself for a kind of reformation, for liberation of women, for a new kind of educational system, for economic openness to the world, for freedom, and they know that they don't have the expertise to do it alone. That's where the United States needs to come together with the other rich nations and say, if you come up with something legitimate, something that reflects your own cultural heritage, but respects freedom and moves towards economic opportunity, we will do our part to help.
We've got half a minute. Any real-world politician carrying your flag, Peter Beinart? Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, you name it. Who? Anybody?
It's a little too early to know what the presidential contenders in 2008 are going to be saying. But I think Joseph Biden has been eloquent about the need for America to be more aggressive, not less aggressive, but in many different ways in fighting this jihadist struggle. And I would keep an eye out for Barack Obama, who has a book coming out next year that's going to talk about some of these issues, and I think may raise some of these themes about how America needs to restore its good name in the world in order for us to inspire the world again.
Peter Beinart, editor-at-large at The New Republic, author of The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again. Peter, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, fighting Dems on their way back?
I think we hear the debate today, people doubting whether they can and people doubting if they even want to.
Well, soon enough, we'll see. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.